You know that.
We'll call the second quarterly meeting of the Board of Regents to order and welcome everyone here. Another momentous day for Western today with the graduation later on and I think 3,300 people getting degrees. Sounds like a big number to me. Secretary Higdon, I'll ask you to call a roll call.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regent Vail.
Present.
Regent Dahmer.
Present.
Regent Ernst.
Present.
Regent Higdon. Present. Regent Henson.
Present.
Regent Johnson.
Present.
Regent McKinney.
Present.
Regent Nichols.
Present.
Regent Porter.
Present.
Regent Ridley.
Present.
Regent Smith.
Present.
Mr. Chairman, we have all members of the board present. We have a quorum.
All right. We have before us our minutes from our February 23rd meeting. And we had time to see that, I believe. I'll take a minute or two to read it, and then we'll entertain a motion for approval of February 23rd meeting.
Second.
Have a motion and a second to approve the minutes from February 23rd meeting. Any discussion? Comments? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion passes. Today is special for several occasions. And, one is our student regent finishes her tour of duty today, and Andy, if you'll join me in front, I think we have a little present. Andy has distinguished herself in many ways, and certainly been a very valuable voice on this meeting. We've been able to serve on the steering committee, the strategic planning process together, and I'm often caught thinking this is the smartest person in the room. She's the youngest or whatever, but she certainly brings a lot of perspectives to any meeting you're in, and we've all enjoyed being on the board with you.
Well, thank you so much. And I just wanted to thank all of you. It's been a real privilege to serve with you. I've learned so much from each of you, and I'm grateful for your mentorship, leadership, and guidance.
Great. We also have in the room with us today Andy's successor, Stephen Mayer. Stephen, just stand up. Let everybody look forward to having you on the board and know that you'll step in running.
Yeah, I'm super excited.
Good. All right. Most of our agenda today will be a consent agenda. The committees of the board met on April 27th. To discuss each item on their respective agendas and recommended submitting the agenda items to the full board for consent action, with the exception of items AA3 and EX4. These items should be removed from the consent agenda for discussion and separate vote. With that, I will ask Chairman Ridley to tell us about the academic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Vail. Today, as Chairman Vail mentioned, that we have AA1 and AA2 as consent agenda items. Both of them extremely important, and I do not want to just run by those because they are on the consent agenda. The emeritus appointment that we have already discussed, the guardian is here, and we would like
recognize him and publicly once again for his service. And I think
Provost Lee has a few comments.
John is my longtime colleague in the history department, 27 years at WKU. He is a remarkable teacher. He has served in significant administrative roles at the dean's level and in the provost's office. The thing that I guess I most applaud him for is what he has done to preserve the African-American heritage in Kentucky. His book on the segregation era of public higher education in Kentucky is a landmark. It's a very significant study. But the thing I particularly applaud him for is his work as editor of the Kentucky African American Encyclopedia, which transcends what typical encyclopedias are in so many ways because it breaks so much new ground, preserves so much information that would have been totally lost without the work of John and his co-editors. And he finished his last class last week, and as the history department does, I just love this. The other faculty members gathered outside the classroom, and as he finished, they applauded. Some folks sang "My Old Kentucky Home," but somebody also showed up with pictures of John on sticks, and so we have a picture of the class with all the students holding up John's picture in front of them. I think that really represents how folks feel about John and the kind of stature that he's achieved for himself during his time here. John is right here.
Certainly an honor, well deserved. Thank you very much for your service to this university, to our community, and our nation. Thank you.
With that, I would entertain a motion to approve AA1 and AA2 on the consent agenda.
So moved.
Second.
And second, all those in favor on the board say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the motion passes. Third item is AA3, and to get that on the agenda, I need a motion that we can then discuss. So I hear a motion for approval of the University Distinguished Professor appointments as indicated in your notes.
So moved.
So move, and second?
Second.
Second. Now the floor is open for discussion and comment. Dr. Lee?
University Distinguished Professor is the highest recognition that this university can bestow on a faculty member. And I'd probably like to take a minute to talk about how this process works out. The process stipulates that this begins with the faculty member in the faculty member's home department. That faculty member's colleagues need to recommend him or her for this position. There's a recommendation from the department head. There's a recommendation from the dean. It then goes to a committee that's made up mostly of other university distinguished professors who review the applications for this and vote on that and then make a recommendation to me. I think Klaus is a university distinguished professor, is part of this committee this year, but that's the process by which university distinguished professors are identified. Like all of our faculty recognition honors, it is faculty-based, faculty-driven, and these are recommendations largely from the peers of the folks I'm bringing forward here this morning. The first person that I would like to recommend to you for University Distinguished Professor is Dr. Farhan Atisi, and she is kind of hiding back here in the corner, but maybe she might stand up for a minute while I talk about her. She earned her doctorate from the University of Nebraska in 1995 and has been at WKU since 2003. She is an internationally recognized expert in the field of time scales, which is an area of research that's kind of on the boundary between pure and applied mathematics. And she has particularly done some important work around modeling cancer tumor growth and how treatment possibilities will work with that. My mathematical skills, frankly, are quite minimal, and I have only a dim sense of what time scales might be. Klaus can maybe elaborate for us. But here's a number that I can comprehend. There are lots of different scientific indices that look at the quality of work that scientists do and mathematicians do. They consistently place Dr. Atisi among the top 5% of the world's mathematicians. I emphasize that because she has also taught 23 different courses in mathematics here at WKU, from introductory mathematics to graduate level courses, and I think that's part of what's distinctive about the WKU experience. world-class scholars who are working with undergraduate students throughout their experience here at WKU. She's an accomplished teacher, scholar, university citizen, and she literally displays all the qualities I think we could be possibly looking for in a university distinguished professor. The second person I would like to recommend this morning is Dr. Aaron Huey, who is in the Department of Counseling and Student Affairs, and Aaron is right here. Aaron's scholarly expertise really falls primarily in the area of student affairs, and especially the interplay between curricular and co-curricular activities. He's done a lot of work around how students persist to graduation, and scholarship especially focuses on the needs of minority students, international students, and at-risk college students. He's got over 50 refereed publications, as well as a textbook and multiple book chapters. And in recognition of his work, he's received the Teaching Award from his college, the Research Award from his college, and the President's Award for Diversity in 2012. Like Farahan, he has taught 30 different classes in counseling and student affairs, and he has developed or co-developed 15 of those. He's also worked extensively with our graduates to place them in positions in student affairs-related work around the country, and he is prolific in sharing his expertise through professional development programs and other kinds of outlets. In short, I think both of these nominees reflect a student-centered applied research university and scholars of significant work, of significant ability, stature in their profession, working with our students throughout their time here at WKU. So, Aaron. And those are my recommendations.
Thank you very much for your recommendations. And also, I think I'll take the liberty to thank the faculty and all those involved for recognizing their group of people in their departments and representing this university that do excel at everything they stand for. And for that, I'd love to do, and we thank the faculty and those involved in showing us, outsiders from the university sometime, who are excelling at what they do. So thank you. Thank you. Any more comments or discussion on the motion on the floor?
I just want to make one comment. This is sort of a highlight of a faculty member's career. I mean, only very few people at this university reach this distinction, and I think this is a lifetime achievement you can be proud of, even long in retirement.
Yes. Any others? With that, I'll call for a vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the motion passes. With that, Mr. Chairman, I thank our business for the academic committee.
I would make one final comment. I think excellence in teaching and professors is our strongest value proposition as we go across the Commonwealth and across the nation, making a case for higher education and why it's important. Those kind of faculty-student relationships that are done by professors of that caliber are critical to our ongoing success. With that, I will turn the meeting over to Chairman Johnson and the Finance and Budget.
Thank you, Bill. As indicated earlier, we have three action items in your packet that were approved at the committee meetings. Action items 1, 2, 3. Would anybody like to remove any of these particular items off the consent agenda? Hearing no such motion, I will now call for a motion for approval of action items FB 1, 2, and 3.
So moved.
And motion second?
Second.
Second. Any discussion, questions regarding any of these three items? Hearing no comments or questions, I will call for a vote. All in favor of action items 1, 2, and 3, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign. Motion carried unanimously. All right, we had originally scheduled a special meeting, which we canceled because it would be easier to do this as an information item within the Finance and Budget Committee for the full board. Nothing changed, but we just decided to put it at the end of this presentation. Let me say this is an information item that's intended to give everyone a heads up as to the decision-making summary with respect to the budget that will be presented in June, and is intended to get us started in that particular direction. So, Ann?
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You have a lengthy agenda item with a lot of numbers. I'm not doing a full presentation of your agenda materials today. You know, when we do present the budget, we'll have 20 or 30 slides that will give much more about the full budget. But today what I wanted to do for you is to focus on the basic decision points we're trying to make at this point before bringing you a budget in June. So there's two sides of a budget, revenue and expenditures. And my job is to make them equal by the time you approve a budget on June 22nd. On the revenue side, I've got the most key decisions in this process. Number one, determine your tuition rates. Number two, what enrollment base are you going to use? And therefore, multiply them together and tell me what my tuition revenue ought to be for the budget. And the last piece, now that the General Assembly has completed their work, what is your state general fund? Those are the two, tuition and state general fund, that's the heart of the budget. On the expenditure side, we determine what we think are our projected fixed costs for the next 12 months. And lastly, our employee salary increase pool objective of 4%. Left side's got equal the right, right, Mr. McKinney? So that's what we're bringing forward to you today. Let me go back on the left side, determining tuition rates. The Council on Post-Secondary Education has approved a maximum tuition parameter as it relates to resident undergraduate tuition. They have approved 6% over 2 years, with 4% as the maximum at any given year. So you could do 2 and 4, or 4 and 2, or any combination, but you're going to do 6 as the maximum for over 2 years. We're bringing forward today a preliminary recommendation that says that in the realm of affordability, that we would like a 3% increase in our resident undergraduate tuition rates starting this fall. Most of the tuition rates that you have in your agenda book are 3% with a few exceptions. You have notes in your agenda items explaining some of the differences. Projected enrollment. We've had a difficult time in our crystal ball and determining exactly what ought to be a reasonable enrollment base. So that's contributed to our challenges this spring with significant budget reductions moving forward in July 1. This model so far includes a reduction in enrollment next year. We will continue to have a decline in international students, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. And we probably haven't turned the corner yet to address the enrollment decline that relates to your part-time students, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. So a projected headcount decline in the 500 to 525 range has been included in our calculations of tuition revenue. We would like to say that we are being conservative, mostly because of all the initiatives that are underway this year that we think we can exceed our enrollment target. However, I've worked over the last 3 months with everyone from admissions to international enrollment to the Office of Institutional Research, looking at who's graduating, what is our normal student progression. So we're advising that we go ahead and budget for an enrollment decline. So that is the last piece. You were updated at the Finance and Budget Committee or the full board meeting, I'm not sure when. We do have a slight decline in state funding For next year, we have an estimate right now of what we will earn in the performance funding pool. I had hoped to know the exact number, so even though I have a number in this agenda item, there could be a small variance as the Council on Post-Secondary Education finishes all the institutions' data sets that determine our exact appropriation. So we have in the budget bill a decline in our state funding, money moved into a performance pool, and we've earned almost all of it back except for about 130,000 of it. On the expenditure side, your normal...
In the document, I'm trying to follow more of what I've read and then what you're going over. The estimate of the enrollment reduction of 5 to 520, is that the 3.9 million that was in the report?
No, sir. That's the projected, to go down a couple lines, 6 million for the thousand. That number is so large, you know, when people hear 500 students out of 16,000, 18,000, it doesn't seem to resonate as a significant number. But when you have, what is the tuition increase, the tuition on international students is in the 13,000 range, a little over 13. When you take that times two semesters, that's why 6 million, number is it?
That's a two-year number.
No. Okay, so I didn't want to confuse people. While the CPE is getting us what we can do over 2 years, we're only doing an annual budget.
Okay.
Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the expenditure side, you have your projected fixed cost increases, which show up on page F7. These are routine items. Given that we...
I apologize for interrupting, but I've got a couple of regents here that don't have this.
Yeah, that's what I'm sharing it with you now.
I'll go make copies. It was emailed. You know, you're saying the revised agenda, but I'll go make copies.
Oh, okay. Okay, can we...
I'll press the pause button.
I apologize. So, do you have one, Klaus?
Well, I printed it out, and that's why I'm sharing
this story.
So I showed it just where the 6 million number was.
I currently also don't have that information.
You get one, okay.
Let's talk about $6 million and put it in context.
Okay.
We just went through a severe, painful process, hours upon hours, of trying to figure out how a $13 million, and again, I'm rounding numbers here, $13 million, and then we turned right around, and after the legislative session, we took another $16 million. And I don't want to just run by a $6 million drop in enrollment, for I don't think it's anybody's surprise that I think it's everyone's right responsibility that we're not recruiting and promoting this great value in this good institution. And I'm not wanting to shame and blame, but I do think it's all of our responsibilities to every student that we know of, every parent, every alumni that we promote in some verbal and nonverbal ways. What a great value this is. And when you take 500 students, if we could shave 200 off of that number, that's a huge difference when it goes back to the headlines of we let 50 folks go. And that impact is not just of the students, it's the reputation of this university. And so I don't want to run by $6 million as if it's something we're just going to have to cope with, because in my opinion, it is truly within our power to change that momentum. It's, yes. Oh, I'm not the chairman.
Go ahead.
So I Richard, really, I completely agree with you. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we've done in this budget is to take into account what the projected enrollment declines would be in the fall, so that in the middle of the year, we're not doing what we had to do this year, which is scrambling and doing mid-year reductions. I think the other point is, there are two other points that are important about this. Number one, we're facing significant international headwinds that are not unlike many institutions across the nation. We have an ongoing search for a new vice provost for global learning, and we must turn the tide on that. But that's a slow go and has significant revenue implications. Last point that I do want to make is that we've been working very aggressively in the past 9 months with on the marketing side, on the recruitment side, on changing the way in which we talk about the institution, our value proposition, and what differentiates us from other institutions in the marketplace. Plus, thinking creatively about the financial aid strategies we use, focused on yields and enrollment. And so, as an institution, we must, and we will turn that corner. But all of that being said, the real challenge we face is the retention challenge. And if we're able to do, through many of the initiatives that you've heard me describe at the investiture, but also through the work the strategic planning group has been doing, think about that first year experience. We have to get our first to second year persistence rate up to 80%. If we just did that, we'd be having a very different conversation today. So that means every one of us has to wrap our arms around every single student and help them get to graduation. It means the students that we recruit, we have to be prepared for them to graduate, and they need to be prepared to do the work that we expect of them. And here's the last thing. You're right. It takes the entire WKU family to make this happen. Every single person, from professor to administrator to president to the folks that are cleaning our residence halls, help do this. And so from my perspective, you can't be more on target.
Just to concentrate on the $6 million is actually sort of misleading in the following sense.
I apologize to you, but should everybody have a copy of this from them? I know Julia went out to get it. Some of you don't. You got one. Julia, you got one? John, do you?
I read it, but I didn't bring it with me.
Oh, okay. She went to get it.
I have a question that deviates a bit from the information.
Wait a minute, he's got four. So go ahead and ask the question. I mean, people may not be able to follow what you're saying.
Right, but I'll give you just some ballpark numbers. I mean, this budget reallocation we have been doing, which is now in phase two, is not just adjusting for the $6 million, but we actually have a $21 million tuition shortfall. And it is basically in the 16-17 year, it's about $4.5 million. In the current budget cycle, it is about $8.5 million. And in the projected next year, it's $6 million, and it totals up to about $21 million. And that's really what this adjustment is for. Now, I want to make sort of a generic comment. I'm sort of new on the board, but these budget reallocation, these budget fixing proposals are really significant. And I'm somewhat surprised that we do not have those as actually voting items on this board. It comes now to us for the second time as an information item. There are significant organizational changes within the university structure, which by far, in my opinion, exceed anything in importance on what we have on the agenda to actually vote on today. So, for example, we dissolved the college. This is one of the major units of the university, which we did not vote on. We are creating a new division of enrollment and student experience, which is a significant change in our organizational structure. It impacts every single student, it impacts every single faculty member. And, if we vote on this in totality on June 22nd in our budget meeting, certainly at that point, any objections anybody might have, that can no longer be voiced because the budget goes online July 1. And so for the future, I would love for us to have these things not as information items, but actually as voting items, because they are very significant in terms of the organizational structure, the student experience, the faculty experience. And I think it needs to be debated whether these things are actually... I mean, change is needed, but the type of change, is that the right change we're making? And I think that's our responsibility to vote on these items.
Anybody want to respond to that other?
So I agree having a conversation about this is important. And one of the things that I know about the organizational shifts that we're making, and I think having that conversation in public is terrific. They're all grounded theoretically. We know what the literature in higher education says about the first year experience. We're drawing from the expertise of institutions across the United States. In many ways, very little of what we're doing is particularly innovative, but together the scope of change is challenging, right? And so you combine that with a budget shift, and I understand the some fear is part of the conversation, but also change. But we're in a place as an organization where, as I've said before, we can't just get smaller. That's not going to change anything. We're a place where we have to think differently about the work that we do. And Klaus, I agree. I think this is going to be an ongoing conversation. It's one of the things that we've done in the strategic planning process, having open forums and feedback and input. And we'll continue that now and in the future.
I would agree with Klaus, and I think those comments were echoed in our committee meeting 2 weeks ago. As a board, our part of shared governance needs to be at the table as well. If it's not premature, I'd like to interject a discussion about the tuition rate increase. And I know there are pros and cons to what we do. But looking at our positions and considering many factors, it would be my suggestion that we entertain the maximum 4% increase for a variety of reasons that would take many minutes to develop. But I am concerned that not taking the 4% as soon as it's available to us has significant impact on the types of things that we can do with regards to addressing the budget situation, with regards to fulfilling our commitment to the staff, the faculty, of a salary increase, as regards to the potential that who knows what lies ahead with upcoming changes at CPE and the leadership and dynamics associated with that. And so granted, we were purported to be entitled to a 6, and we can take it in any combination that we would like, but I would propose us seriously considering taking the 4 this first time up, as opposed to, for example, 2 threes. I think 4 to 2 is more in my thought of fulfilling our fiduciary responsibility to this university. To echo Regent Ridley's comments, we are an institution of value. We may can do a better job of claiming that value and marketing it, but the truth is that we are an institution of value. Suffice it to say that the 4% is not out of line with what I believe is a competitive environment.
The rest of the board, the preliminary rates are on F10. Back to the first block on the left side. The resident undergraduate rate is $5,256 with a 3% increase. That number, with rounding to the nearest credit hour, which makes it easy for accountants, would say that the difference between a 3 and a 4 would be $48 for a resident undergraduate that's full-time. $48 a semester.
More on top of what's here.
Correct. This is a 3% increase.
What's the total?
To put a number with the 4%.
What's the total impact that a 1%, additional 1% add to the budget?
It's in the 1.5 million range, plus or minus.
How much are we depending on carry forward?
3.5.
You know, my comment, that difference, that number of 1.5 is a forever number. It's just not a one you get. That's why it's right on through. So if you forego that, you forgo the
life. Andy.
One point that I'd like to make, so the
when we talk about increasing tuition, and then we also talk about retention, I think it's important to evaluate the type of burden that this places on students and how it may impact retention. So I'd sort of like to evaluate that a little bit more. But then also, in talking about not just increasing tuition, but the impact of fees. So the thing that I really liked most about the Budget Council recommendations back in February was the fact that President Cavoni accepted that we should conduct a comprehensive evaluation of all university fees. And I think that's extraordinarily important. But then I recently had a meeting with Provost Lee, and he discussed an additional fee per credit hour for all online courses. So that's an additional burden for students that would be assessed. I think it would be totaling about $1 million based on...
About $1.6 million.
Okay, $1.6 million. And so then we're talking about this additional raising in tuition. But if we do end up increasing the 4%, I think it's really frustrating that we would also interject an additional distance learning fee, because that's doubly burdening the students. So I haven't really seen any of the aspects of the Budget Council like come to fruition as far as the evaluation of these fees. So I don't think it's fair at this time to conduct or to assess an additional fee and raise tuition when we still have not accepted this comprehensive eval. I think that it's sort of like choosing one or the other from a student perspective, especially if it's $1.5 million versus $1.6
million. Let me
just provide some clarifying information. The current online fee for a full-time student that's taking one of their courses online would be $100 per credit hour on top of the full-time load. And what's being considered is increasing it to $150 per credit hour. It's a note down at the bottom of the tuition schedule. This, obviously, when we were looking to reduce budgets in the $18 million range, was extremely challenging. We made every effort all the way to late April to identify all the strategies to minimize the impact on students, protect core services. No one wants to raise tuition. No one wants to raise fees. This was just one variable in comparison to some of the other universities. There's a table in your agenda material indicating that, you know, we're not the highest, we're not the lowest. There are other universities that, in fact, have decided if you want to take an online course, you pay the full rate per credit hour and you pull it out from your load. So we knew that this would be one of your concerns, so that's one reason the provost met with you prior to the meeting.
And one thing I'd like to add, too, is there are certain classes, a number of them, as Provost Lee has evaluated, they're offered exclusively online, so it's the professor's independent decision to only offer that class online. And so I think that assessing this additional burden when tuition is already increasing is, one, not fair to those students who have to take those required classes in order to graduate. And then also, if the students are already committed to these courses, the semester has ended, like finals end today. So these students would not be informed of this additional burden until summertime. Many of them won't be checking emails, so they'll come back in the fall and then just be assessed these fees. So I just think that, I guess, like the implementation of this begs some questions. And it's important to look into hybrid course offerings, because if there are 1,100 contact hours, then you could do an in-person and online hybrid course, and it would not need to assess this fee. It would just be a bit of extra work for the professors involved.
Yes, sir. If you want to respond, I'm going to go ahead and respond to her questions. I mean, she's got the floor right now.
Particularly related to the required courses that are offered only online. I wish you could have seen my face when I heard that for the first time. Here's my question that I asked back. Number one, why are we having full-time students required to take an online course when they're full-time in-person students? And that's the only option for them. And if we are going to do that, why are we burdening them with the additional fees? So one of the things that we're looking at is how can we, for those students today, for required courses that are not offered in-person, how do we discount those in such a way that not only are they not affected by the $50 fee, how do we take away the other $100 fee as well? I don't think that it makes sense for us to have online courses that are required for in-person students that impose an additional financial burden. So we're going to take, that's one of the things I've asked folks to take a look at during the next month. But the other is, and this is an academic question, what's the process through which, by which we decide what courses are offered online, particularly required courses? And is that a, that is a strategic conversation, a curricular conversation, not in, in, not to the ease of faculty conversation. And so one, as we move through this, I think we must take a look at both core and degree offerings to make sure that any time we offer only online, that that is a strategic decision done for a particular reason, not for the ease of an individual. Okay. And so we're going to work on that.
Agreed. Thank you.
Is that it? Andy?
Yes.
Okay. Ash, you want to go again?
Yes. So I believe that the way we are sort of budgeting this is not quite correct. Okay, and so let me just sort of tell you, it's sort of an elementary exercise of economics that when the price goes up, demand goes down. And so in this budget, what we're seeing here, we increase this fee by 50% from 100 to 150, and assuming that we have the current enrollment and sort of budgeted, which I think is probably somewhat questionable. I believe that in a wider context, that if I look at our tuition fee structure, first of all, there's a bewildering, an absolutely bewildering number of fees, which nobody actually fully understands. I certainly don't. Second, our pricing is really absolutely strange, to say the least. So, for example, take this fee on an online course, okay? Well, an online course ought to be cheaper than a in-class course. There is no classroom to provide. There is no building to heat. There is... that it ought to be somewhere cheaper, but what are we saying? It's actually significantly more expensive. But I can go a little bit further. So, for example, I just quote you a number. If I'm in the PhD program, the doctorate of educational leadership, I'm paying a graduate resident tuition rate, which is actually lower than our generic graduate rate. And so I think this needs to be looked at. I just cannot conceive that if somebody gets a master's in history, that this ought to be more expensive than if somebody is in a doctorate program. But that's what we're currently doing. And that's, it's, to me, it's quite bewildering.
Klaus, I agree with you. We need to take a very comprehensive look at both fee structure and the way in which we charge tuition. We're bringing in to work with us both on financial aid and the way in which we craft this. Noel Levitz, they do this for universities all across the nation. It's absolutely the work that we're going to do. On the pricing, the economics make sense, but you have to take into account elasticity. And so, I know, but I want to make that point. And that what we see in the in our market is the suggestion that there is some elasticity in our tuition pricing. If the market position as an applied research university is just below the R1s in the state and just above comprehensives, then we think that there's some elasticity there, and I think we can do this plus grow not just demand but enrollment. And that's the elasticity question. Bo Levitz is going to help us nail that down. But it is a point very well taken.
Georgie. Go ahead.
Wow. What a perfect storm. That's really where we're at. When you think about a new president, a new budget process we've gone through with the state system, declining enrollment, this is really challenging to get your arms around. We're talking about whether we increase the tuition based on what the requirements are. Actually, like Fred's suggestion, I think we do as much as we can in the beginning and try to, but I didn't know this other stuff about the impact on students. But there's two questions here for me. One is process. And I don't think we're doing very well right now in process. If we're having this conversation, and if I'm not mistaken, June is next month, it's sort of scary that we're having the conversation. And I don't know how we as a board from a fiduciary responsibility can somehow or another get up to speed and get better situated so we can give better advice and guidance and suggestions to your committee. Because, one, I'm grateful you're leading the committee and we're having this debate, but somehow or another I think we're missing something. Because at the end of the day, if we are setting off with something in June that starts in July, I don't feel really comfortable about that because I don't feel like I have my arms around it. So we have this process issue that somehow or another we should try to get our arms around very quickly so that all of us can feel better in June. And I don't know if that's cause or whatever it is, but something so we feel better in June and we can give you the support you need so that we can move forward. And we have to think about all the pieces around that, the communications, the impact on students, the university, the whole economics game that we're playing here. But I'm really struggling with this process question and then these major questions that just as a university, again, it's a perfect storm. We had all these things happening at once and we're trying to move forward. And I think all of us, my personal conversation with most, we're pretty comfortable directionally where we're going. But we really ought to try to make sure we can do a better job of how we go about doing that. So that I'm okay making tough decisions. I want to feel good that I went through the right process and did it from an informed perspective. And so somehow or another, if we could get our arms around that, I just think that would be helpful.
If I can respond to that, because I think those are excellent points that have been discussed here before you came on. So the thought process has been here. About that, about the issue of timing, enough time to examine the records and make decisions based upon that. We've had a process in place for a lot longer than I've been here, and as anything gets set in stone, it is hard to pull the sword out of the rock. And in this particular case, the president has undertaken to change that model. And we are at the front door of going through to change that model to address precisely some of the issues you had, except the problem is we've got a budget that we have to come up with by the end of the year. So hence the perfect storm, I presume, is where it comes from. And I think that's exactly what you're doing. I'll let President Caboni address that side of it, but that's the new budget side of it. And Chairman Bell had changed the meeting dates in order to try to push this forward. And then another small thing that we've done is to come up with this information item to give you big ticket items that we need to consider. For example, we're talking about 3% raise in tuition. If we can go around this board and maybe come to consider it, that'll be 2 or that'll be 4. But then that gives a message back to the administration saying, okay, it needs to be 4 as an example. Same issue with the $150 versus the $100. We did not beforehand have the opportunity to discuss these matters at this length before today. And so it's starting to change. I'm glad you recognize it.
And again, so from that, then I guess as a follow-up, so what can we do to help your committee, the president, the university, get through this then? In a way that we all feel comfortable about. I don't know the answer, but, yeah. I really want to help. I understand everything I'm looking at. It's just,
Well, one thing, and Jason has said this to me as a member of the committee, and he says, can we get the budget out soon? You know, it's a hard process giving. We've got to deal with when the General Assembly finishes. We've got to deal when the CPE makes its decisions. All that stuff starting to come into place. And then we have to do it based upon projections as to enrollment, retention. We've had those same elements in the form of the past.
So following along and how you were planning to do this, and I like simplicity, okay? Is there any way for the more knowledgeable regents and the president and Ann and her team I got the tuition and all that, but there's still other issues. There's impact on students. What are the top 5-6 items that, because everything else becomes formulaic, what are the real important issues that we as a board should give you input on? And that should not be complicated or difficult for us to say, here's our thoughts, okay? Tuition rates, that's one. What's the impact on students? Well, let's lay out. Well, there's fees, and here's what that number looks like in real dollars, because I'm only worried about an individual student, those type of things. So what's the 4, 5, 6 things that are really, really critical that we can give you our input on, and then you can go make decisions so that everything will begin to roll up in the time frame that you have? And we as a board should be saying, here's the things I think are, and then you all can ultimately make the decision. It shouldn't be a laundry list of stuff. But what's the real critical things? Because we can't do all of it and then give you a budget in the time frame that we're working in.
Well, I think the most crucial thing, crucial element, is the expenditure side of it. And I think the board can turn around and say, okay, these are the areas that we think we need to enhance, maintain, improve. Yeah. These are the areas that are not producing where we are. We've got a policy. We've got to adopt a policy that simply says, as a board, we want to change this. We want to eliminate this. We want to add this, whatever that may be. And I think that's the performance model that we're trying to move to. But those are the elements. Those are the very elements.
So talk to me about that. And then we sit down and we can opine on that, and then you all have guidance. And I think all of us would feel better now that we've had input. I understand why this was informational, especially since this is new information.
Yes.
So that makes sense. But to keep you on your timeline, I would still love to understand and lay it all out so we can give input to that.
May I respond to Richard Nix? It's absolutely what we're trying to do this cycle.
I get it.
And my understanding is that we now have 6 weeks between now and a vote at the end of June where everyone has the materials. Is that, I think that's a longer period of time.
As long as we've had.
As long as we've ever had.
As long as we've ever had.
So the way this used to work, is the budget came out a couple weeks before that June meeting, the week before.
Not even that much.
It
wasn't that much.
And so what we, so while it feels like there is a time crunch, what we've created, at least in this go-around, is 6 weeks of space. I hope next year, given the tuition has been set for 2 years, we have a longer period of time. So we're working on it. It's a point very well taken.
Maybe I should disregard everything I said.
No.
I was not aware of that.
Really? So how you make a decision when somebody puts something like it in front of you over that short of time? I don't know how to do that.
Difficult, if not impossible, and that's why that change has been, the change is going.
Okay.
I mean, that's
thank you.
John was doing.
You know, I've been sitting here listening to this, and this is my sixth year being on this board, and I've been trying to think of something really, really smart to say. And I don't know that I can do that and articulate it in the way that my head is thinking through this, but I'm going to give it an attempt. First of all, where we are in a point in time, many times we do not look over our shoulder to see where we have come from, where we came, what's been behind us. And so if we look over our shoulder in the short 9 months, we have almost entirely turned the ship in a direction that is for the future. You know, we created this over a long period of time. We've accepted how the state government has given us a budget at the last minute. We scramble to try to make best do that we can, and the big picture is to try to keep the doors open, everybody employed, and keep the value proposition. That's really the big picture here. And with all due respect to everything that has been said, it gets down to something, and it is, if we want this to keep going, we've got to act. And it may not be with every detailed information we have, because every point is certainly important. But the next step is to focus on the future. And I agree with Freddie. I think you ought to take it, you ought to take the pain as quick as you can and get the focus back on the mission. And so I'm all in favor of increasing the tuition wherever. I'm all about reducing the fees and doing a focused study on what is the real impact. Because when I'm sitting in my kitchen with my child and say, I'm going to this university or that university, it's not about the fees, it's not about the tuition, it's the cost. It's all the costs, and that's what we've got to focus on, and then educating those and retaining them. So I mentioned about retention, but the last thing I'll say on this is as we get to these stages, I don't want there to be any misunderstanding that this board has not been involved, that they have been, and I'm speaking more to the press, that we have been digging down into the deepest part of the opportunities at this university to expand the value. And that's what we need to look over our shoulder. And the future is we've got to exercise our best knowledge that we have given to us and make a decision. And I think we've got the leadership in place. We've certainly got the conscious efforts of the faculty and the staff. And we're going forward with this in a vigor that will put us in a better place in the future. So with that, I'm trying to bring us back to the focus.
Andy?
I do not mean to harp. These will be my last two questions for this section, hopefully. But regarding the comprehensive evaluation of the fees, when is this intended to be conducted or presented to students?
So I think we'll do that during the next year. So we focus immediately on the budget situation at hand. There are larger recommendations from the Budget Council that we'll be addressing during the next 12, 18 months. It's one of the reasons the levies is coming. We're waiting for the provost to arrive. But all of this, we're doing some air traffic control here, right? And so a recipe for success is doing everything all at once, and so we're going to try to stage these things. But staging in such a way that we're addressing the ones that have revenue implications first, and then retention first. The other things that are important but not necessary to be first won't be, but we're going to do that over the next year.
And then the final question, so when I first came here with SGA, students have always really complained about this fee for online courses, specifically those that are exclusively offered online. And I've always heard that the $100, even though there was no building, no fee, AC, lights, it was necessary because it was a DLO fee for distance learning. It was helping to pay for the people who work in DLO, et cetera. But this $50 addition really seems to just focus on the deficit that we've already accrued. And so I'm wondering if there's any plan in place in the future to make these fees less reliant on the debt that we already have, or to simply use them for like the sole purpose of paying for the faculties in which they need to pay. And then I've also heard things like, oh, well, you know, it's inelastic, like we can gouge if we need to, or it's to disincentivize people from taking these online classes when they could take in person. So I guess, like, what is actually necessary to pay for the DLO portion and what's being used for other purposes?
So I think that is part of the conversation around the new budget model. When you think about the way it works today, revenue comes in, and where does that revenue stay is the question. And today, those online courses, the revenue lives with DLO, and there's some shifting back and forth. In the new budget model, what you have are revenue-generating units, the folks that actually enroll, keeping a vast majority of that and thinking about how it supports the operation of those units. And then there is a tax, if I hate to use that word, but there is some portion that is distributed to the support functions. And so if you think about what those are, that's the academic affairs, not colleges, but academic affairs administrative functions. It's the student enrollment functions. It's the public affairs and recruitment functions. It's all those pieces that enable those five colleges to do the work that they're going to do. And DLO is one of those support functions. So in the new budget model, I think the question has to be, what's the percentage of or how much revenue from an online student is shared between the college and DLO, and those are all parts of the ramp process right now. So you're spot on, and we have to disentangle a lot of things as an institution before we get there. But I think we've made good progress, and the summer when we spend a significant time, we talked about perhaps July, around strategic planning and the new budget model, I think we're really going to be able to tease some of that out and demonstrate what those dollars do in a way that is much more transparent.
Thank you.
George?
I just want to clarify one thing that Andy said, just for the record. I hope gouging and elasticity are not the same. They're not the same where I come from. Okay. And I don't believe the university's ever tried to gouge our students.
No.
I'm sure they felt that way. I won't argue that point, but I just want
to. Well, you know, to go to your point, it seems to me that the most time spent here, the last few minutes talking, is about the revenue side of it. And sometimes we forget about the expense side of it. And the comment you made, President Boney, that I think is important, is that DLO is a revenue source, and it does support other functions of the university, as other departments and programs do as well. That's changing in the model to go forward, and here we are, as George pointed out, in the eye of that perfect storm, trying to figure out which direction we need to go, and we're surrounded. But to another point that was made, I want to point out, and that is the budget process started some time ago. And this is one of the first times that I've ever seen an active, engaged budget council work with us. So the process is changing, and it is developing and will develop. Klaus?
I have one more thing I wanted to make you all aware of, and that's something I think you would like to see addressed in the budget model, and that's the following. If you look at the projected fixed cost increases, there's an item there, student financial aid, and that's about $500,000. What is that? So this is essentially that our athletic scholarships essentially increase every time tuition rates are increased. That's what that's for. However, what I want you to be aware of, that there are many other units which are really negatively impacted by tuition increase. So I'll give you an example of my department. We have a fixed budget for our graduate teaching assistant. And every time tuition increases, the stipends we can essentially pay will be decreased because out of the stipend, the tuition has to be paid. And basically, we are not competitive within our region for mass TAs already. And every time we do this basically decreases our capacity. And so how have we reacted? And I'm sure there are other programs which have reacted exactly the same way. In order to stay even reasonably close to what we need to offer, we cut down the number of assistantships we have, because that's the only option we're given. And so there are many other units on the university which are affected by a tuition increase, and currently there is no mechanism in place which actually compensates for this. So the other large unit, which I want to mention, well, prominent unit, not large, is Gatton. Gatton faces a long-term problem in the sense that they have a fixed allocation, and every time tuition increases, we need to charge them more for the classes they're taking, and currently there is no mechanisms to compensate for that.
Regents, you are absolutely right, and here is the challenge that we're going to address head-on. We have to stop thinking about financial aid as an expenditure, even though, as you're describing it, it is, because those are real dollars, cash in the barrel, that you're spending on tuition. We must begin to shift our mindset from financial aid or scholarships or assistantships, tuition assistantships, being money expended, and we must move to a net tuition revenue model. That means we have to stop thinking about $1,500 spent on a student who otherwise wouldn't be here as $1,500 spent. It's $8,500 gained on the revenue side. And so that means the model we should move to, and it's not just for undergraduates, it's not just for athletics, it's not just for debate and Gatton, it should be for every department across campus, is how are we leveraging a discount to generate revenue? It's a very different conversation than what we've ever had before, and we're going to get there. It's put all the different pieces, particularly at the undergraduate level, for next fall. But I think we also have to address it for graduate students as well. It seems crazy to me that we would think about not discounting because if we're spending dollars out of a budget on tuition instead of using it as a discount, I think that's not where we should be, and we're not going to be there for a long time.
All right. We have a long agenda today, and I know Terrence Bear wants us to get someplace else. Anne, anything else?
I'm deferring back to you to see what you'd like from me, and whether we want to regroup after the meeting and talk what might be the best next.
Well, I think the suggestions I've heard, unless I hear something different around the table, is an increase certainly up to 4%. And I think I've heard around the table that there is some concern about the $50 increase. So I guess maybe we'd have to develop these numbers a little bit differently, at least in those two items. An increase to 4%, am I saying that correctly? Does anybody disagree with it? We're not voting, but that's what I've heard.
I thought we can reach the same conclusion, $50 increase elasticity of that thing, which is a very appropriate.
No, I'm, well,
we're trying to get out of here and just feel good about this. I don't think it's an either or. We're going to get rid of $50 and we're going to increase it 4%. We're going back to not looking at the big picture because we're just trying to make everybody happy. I mean, we're going to have to focus on what the real issue is, and we've got to plug a hole in a budget. And I'm sorry if it's $50 increase. I will say there's been comments made here as well. You don't have a building and so forth and so on, and so therefore it should be cheaper. That's not a statement that's accurate, that we can't focus on that, because just because there isn't a building to house, the reason you got here is because there was a building. The reason we're offering these programs is because we've already come a long direction. So you just can't all of a sudden one day say, well, I'm going to start offering online because I don't need a building. There isn't a retailer in the country that adds a product line and says, well, we're going to do this because we don't have to have a building. Well, they've had a building, and the reason they can do this, they have a brand, they have a process, they have everything involved, and that is overhead that has to be covered. So it concerns me that we get to a point and not look on the big picture and take the advice of people that have spent hours on looking into this, and then we get down into the weeds and say, well, we're going to do this or that. And I just don't agree with that. I do agree with an increase. If the budget says that we need to have $50, I agree with that as well. This is about the big picture, and we've got to get to the next stage so we can complete these strategic plans that are already in line. So that's my opinion.
George,
I would rather see you all go back and regroup after this meeting.
Exactly.
Based on what we were saying is, what are the major items that we should be giving input on?
Right.
Okay, and then the impact that it has both from a university perspective and a student perspective. And then we get to make an informed decision about whether it's $50, $100, exactly. $4 or $3 or whatever. Because I don't want to, there's a lot of issues here. That's why I was saying, what are the top ones that are important? Not just a numbers perspective, but there is a real impact. There's elasticity, but there's students. And there's costs. And then, so I'd rather you all go back and figure that out and lay that out for us, and then come back and send us a note or whatever and tell us what we need to get input to. I just think that would be better because...
I don't disagree with that. Then we'll do it in that regard. But I want to echo something John just said, and that is you pull one of these numbers out on the revenue side, you've got to pull it out on the expenditure side. So, you know, it's easy, John, as you point out, considering, say, okay, we'll drop that $50, but then where do we make that? Somebody else gets hurt.
But you all can tell us that as we go through.
I understood that to be your question. Tamil?
Just briefly, and I agree with what John said as well. I mean, online, you still have the IT back support. You've still got things. You still have costs associated with it. It's not just less expensive. And I understand that some elasticity to increase the fees. But what I have heard since this came out, and I just want to say from numerous people, you know, back around campus, the concern that we're overpricing and we're pricing ourselves out, that we're going to take this $50, and I understand why and when we're doing that, I'm not disagreeing with that in any way, form, or fashion, but if we start seeing a further decrease in enrollment because we priced ourselves out of the market, which we have seen happen in several departments across campus already, so that's my concern. We may have to do this, but at what cost to ourselves in the long term?
If I may, I completely agree. And so the delicate balance on this is as you're changing your pricing, you have to pair that with increasing demand, right? And the way you do so, it's matching marketing and recruitment with that shift. If you don't increase demand, you will see it go down. So during my career, I've done this over and over again, right? You have to be able to aggressively market, tell the story, increase demand, increase the top of the funnel and yield at the same time you're doing this. If you just keep doing what you've been doing and then pull the price lever, you are going to see a decline in volume.
Exactly.
And so you got to do both at the same time.
Exactly. I just like to say that we plugged a $30 million budget hole with only cost, and we do need to look at some revenue side. I think we've done an excellent job. We've made drastic cuts to the point where we're at the end of the possibilities, so we do need to look at revenue. We're still dependent on $3.5 million in carry forward to plug the final hole in the budget, so revenue needs to be an option.
And Dr. Cabani, I'm assuming we're looking at dual credit as well.
Dual credit is set differently, and we have to be so careful about that because we can't risk a scholarship opportunity for students. So it is priced incredibly low.
It is horribly low. And you come in and you have students that already have a first year done, completed, and you have parents that work at this university that tell their students, get all the classes you can, dual credit, so I don't have to finish paying the rest of your tuition when you get to be a junior or senior. So I'm just thinking dual credit needs to be addressed as well. Seems like there's, you know, there's overhead there as well.
Dual credit, particularly when you think about it as a market for students to enroll. And so we have to do more there. And to Regent McKinney's point on the revenue side, for university, there are a limited number of revenue places, right? And one place is tuition, and you can grow the revenue there one of two ways, increasing tuition or increasing the number of students. Number two, through persistence and retention, which we're working on. And number three, what are the innovative new programs that we can build that will attract new interest, and we're working on that too. So on that side, we've got to be innovative, we've got to push, and I think the things that we've been talking about in the strategic planning process are going to get there. But on the revenue side, there's some limits, but also there are opportunities, public-private partnerships. How do we partner with companies? How do we create new online offerings that are done in tandem with community colleges and high schools to lower the cost but increase demand? So all that is absolutely, we're moving that.
Okay. Thank you, Chris and Tony. And Chairman Bell, that concludes.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Anson. Good discussion, and it's a longer, earlier discussion on these matters than we've ever had since I've been here before. So we are making progress, and I think Regent McKinney voiced that this time last year, or rang the bell that we need to move this stuff up. And thanks for your all's good work.
It'll get better.
Yes. We have a couple of consent action items on the executive committee. Is there anyone that would like to hold one of those off of the consent agenda?
No, but I do have a question after we do our action.
Okay. On
process.
Okay. We have item number one, approval of the athletic employment contract, Coach Greg Collins. And item number two, approval to authorize a memorandum of lease agreement with the College Heights Foundation. We had presentations of both of those at our committee meetings. And does anyone care to make a motion? Motion.
Second
by Julie to approve items number one and two as presented. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye. Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Okay, the next item concerns approval of naming designated room areas. And I believe we have John Paul Blair here with us today to tell us about that.
Yes, thank you. And this will just take a couple of minutes, but appreciate the opportunity to share about some exciting new naming opportunities for the campus and briefly about those who are making the gifts. You all have a list at your place. The first one is Terry Gilpin, and Terry is a 1969 graduate, and following a long-time career in healthcare, he is now consulting in St. Petersburg. He's active in our Tampa alumni chapter, and his gift support is for the Augustine Alumni Center, and we'll name the grand staircase there. The next gift is from William and Christiana Turner to name a faculty office, and then here in Honors College, Will is a 2007 graduate and is director and senior counsel for the world's largest equity derivatives clearing organization. The Turners have established an endowment for them here in Honors College with preference given to those studying at Harlaxton College and pre-law studies. And as a side note, the gift conversation with the Turners began
in September at the very first alumni event that the president attended in Chicago. Next is Beulah Winchell, and Beulah is a 1939 Western Kentucky State Teachers College graduate who went on to earn a master's degree from Peabody College, and in 2015, Beulah died at the age of 103, and she began her career after she left WKU in a one-room classroom in Breckenridge County and traveled around the world teaching in Japan, France, and other exciting places, and retired back home to her beloved Breckenridge County. Her philanthropy has been considerable and will establish four separate endowments in WKU libraries, the Kentucky Museum, the Department of Agriculture, and an endowment for the WKU farm, and an endowed scholarship to support Kentucky students studying elementary education, middle grades education, and agriculture. And pending approval, we will have a naming ceremony later this spring to name the Beulah Winchell Education Library. A couple more. Cliff Todd, who we did talk about last meeting. Cliff is a 1950 WKU graduate and owner of Todd Enterprises in Louisville. His gift has provided the funding for the Cliff Todd Center, which will house the College Heights Foundation, and also for the President's Home, where the Cliff Todd Gardens that's being proposed will be named as well. Cliff's been a longtime WKU philanthropist and has provided support for our faculty through the endowment of the Todd Professorship for Longevity and Healthful Living. And then lastly, a gift from Dr. Jack and Janice Glasser to name the WKU Baseball Press Box. And Jack is the chief physician at the Glasser Clinic here in Bowling Green. Prior to that, he grew up on the Hill. He was a College High graduate and later played a little baseball and was an academic All-American for the Hilltopper baseball team. And Jack and Janice have made a nice gift to support his program. So I submit these six naming opportunities for your approval.
All right. Very nice. Any questions or comments on any of those? I'll entertain a motion to accept.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Very nice. Well done.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Since this has been on the agenda, and through, once again, I mentioned I've been on the board 6 years, I recall that each time there is a naming opportunity that there is a process that it goes through, whether it be through philanthropy or designation of a park bench on the campus. So when someone makes a decision of placing a name upon a named opportunity, there is a process. And I don't want this to sound insensitive, but if that is a process and we're to go through with that, the reason we have processes is so there's not always one off or something. Even though it may be a great idea, if you just follow the process. Recently, I noticed that the ribbon cutting of our, and I do not remember this ever coming before this board as approval, and how it got through the process without it doing that, I'm not sure. But the new Ogden College building, which is brand new, there is a cornerstone with some folks' name etched in it. And I do not recall that ever coming through. And if that is something that is now being a process that we are not aware of, I think it needs to be brought to the board's attention. Whether someone makes an alternative decision to say, well, we're going to do this for a particular reason, I think it, we need to be sensitive to the circumstances, but at the same time, it should go through the process. So I'm asking, as a board member, how that happened, why it happened, and why it has not been brought before the board to have the naming opportunity placed on the building. So that's a pretty significant place. Certainly, there are circumstances around things that there could be other appropriate and most sensitive types of things, but I was unaware of that for 3 months. So I'm not addressing that to John Paul. That's just a general comment that I think that if we're going to do that, then it needs to be broadly understood.
You really find
yeah,
that,
please.
Because of your inquiry and John Paul, I've had a conversation. I've asked some questions about the way in which that process unfolded. And we've made really clear internally that decisions that are made about naming opportunities all go through the process. There is no way around that any longer. That was a presidential decision that was made before I got here.
Really? Well, I guess that's similar to how the process happened to get the Downing Center changed, the name of the Downing Center. So thank you for that information.
That's all, Mr. President.
All right. Chair.
The next item is approval of a provost letter of appointment. Professor Terry Ballman will soon be joining our university for our campus.
I would like to call, if you would, in to be Provost Ballman's contract. If you look at item number six, there was some concern in the Budget Council about the way in which folks who departed the provost position returned to the faculty, and Provost to be Ballman and I had a conversation about her. Her time here, and she not only was willing but completely understood the way in which her faculty salary would be calculated at the culmination of her service and when she returned to the faculty. And so I just want to point that out. It was a concern expressed by the Budget Council and one that we dealt with not through a policy change but actually through a conversation and negotiation, which is what I described we would do in February. We're very excited to have her join us.
Forward to meeting her. John Paul, I think you have an information item.
We need to take a vote.
We need to take a vote, yeah.
I'm sorry. We need approval for this letter of appointment.
I'll second.
Jensen. Richard Johnson, second. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Letter of appointment is approved. All right, John Paul.
Yes, again, very quickly, I believe you all have it at your place. So a one-page summary of some year-to-date highlights from philanthropy and some upcoming events. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to share that our division team is pleased to share that at the end of March, with still a full quarter to go, that we eclipsed our all-time high in outright gifts to the university. And the number that's a little over 23 million is a new number for us. I can also say that that as of today that we are now over 24 million, and by fiscal year end we expect to be very near or above 25 million for the first time. So below that number are listed some, there's some category listings. The first is, are the gift sources reflecting the growth that we've experienced this year. And beginning with alumni, you can see alumni contributions so far have increased 68%, and then so on down the line from foundations and corporations. I want to highlight again, as I was able to briefly a couple of meetings ago, that our faculty staff support is up significantly. There are some major gifts there that have increased that number by 100% over last year, but also the number of faculty and staff supporting has increased as well. And we had a reception just a couple of weeks ago. It's right at 700 members of our faculty and staff to this point in the year have made a gift, and we were able to have a reception and thank them for that recently. The next group, again, just highlights some gift categories. I'll just point out a couple of them. Major gifts, you can see we've had a 95% increase, almost 18 million. Major gifts at WKU is an annual gift of $10,000 or more. Also in parentheses, you can see that the volume of major gifts have grown from 195 to 249. Endowment gifts have increased 62% and represents about 30% of the gifts made to WKU are in the form of endowment. And student financial aid continues to be a primary focus, and
and even an elevated focus with the emphasis on the WKU Opportunity Fund. We're excited about that opportunity as we move forward. And then some additional categories with increased totals, again, speaking not only to the dollar amounts, but the fact that President Circle membership is growing, total donors are growing, and total gifts as well. And finally, WKU's endowment is at an all-time high of more than $173 million. And to give you some context historically, endowment, when we started our first campaign at WKU in 1998, and Regent Ridley is smiling, he was on that campaign cabinet, we were at $24 million at that point. At the end of the campaign, it rose to $58 million. And following in campaign two, in 2012, endowment stood at $118 million. So we're pleased to see where our next campaign effort takes us as we go forward. And then some special events. Wednesday night, the president gathered with Northern Kentucky alumni. And between now and the end of the month, he will attend, or the end of next month, excuse me, he will attend five more events, concluding with a Washington, D.C. event hosted by Regent Nichols. And we will also jump through every one of our 27-county service region. I don't know if we've officially named our Big Red Caravan yet, but
apparently
we'll,
just did.
We'll do that. Also, in June, Robin and I and many others are working on that trip as well. So as we conclude this record-breaking year of philanthropy, there will be many more significant gift announcements this spring. I referenced Ms. Winchell's. So things are progressing. The strategic plan we're excited about is it lays the foundation for our next campaign to see where we might be able to climb to.
Okay. Well, thank
you. John Paul, can we add that the Louisville presidential welcome event was the largest one we've had so far?
I will add that. We had 150-plus in attendance, and Regent Henson planned, and we executed it beautifully. She invited the red shirts to come, an a cappella group, and it was a great night. I know several regents were there, and we concluded with their singing of our fight song and had a great time. It set the bar real high, Regent Nichols.
Can I get like a cheat sheet on with you? We were just thinking we would have like pizza and beer and never come over, but obviously that's not what I should be doing.
That works too.
I got to raise the bar.
I'm not competitive at all,
George. I can tell.
If you visit that long group, that might be the best way to celebrate the
long.
So,
Freddie. Mr. Chairman, I had the opportunity to serve on the strategic planning committee for gifting program with Tom Smith and John Paul. And these two guys are doing a tremendous job. Obviously, this is proof in the pudding, but what is remarkable is that when you look at their staffing numbers, personnel numbers to repair, I don't know how to get the job done, but not only do they bring home the bacon, they are doing it as efficiently as anywhere in this university setting that I've seen. So, Donald and John Paul, thank you guys.
I think it's also worth noting, I think many of the regents at the investiture had the opportunity to go down to see the Cynthia and George Nichols Intercultural Student Engagement Center. I think I got that right. But what a gift to the university that you all made, certainly sets a high bar for all of the rest of us as regents to contribute in as many ways as we can, but
thank you.
Quite a gift.
I love talking about wonderful things. That to me is the pinnacle of what we're doing, is what are the results. And 30 years of being in the investment business, I can assure you that money chases results. It does it in every circumstance. And the results of the last 9 months are proof that what we are seeing, there was not a break of confidence in this university. There was not a break in the understanding of what our mission is. the continuation of people making contributions to this university have been tremendous. An example of a brand new board member and his spouse contributing to the importance of student education and advancement culturally and in our society. I think we should celebrate those things, as Freddie says, with those that have done the heavy lifting, those that have participated, and we all can take vicariously a wonderful feeling that this university is on a mission to succeed at everything that we do. And for that, I applaud everyone. Everyone. Well, thank you.
Cheer, Bill. following up along with that, there is no doubt that the past several months have been very difficult and very challenging and painful for the faculty and staff. But I'm thrilled to see that we've had a 100% increase in donations from that, and proud to be one of those donors as well. But you know, it takes a lot. We're going through some very difficult times and still going through those times, but to still turn around and be willing to write a check back to the university because we believe in what's going on. We believe in the president and we believe in the mission. So I applaud and want to, you know, publicly state my thank you to all those staff who, you know, aren't always making the big bucks, but they're willing to give back because they do believe in our mission, and the faculty for what they donate back, because we're here because we believe in WKU and we want to support that. As alumni, I know I feel an obligation that I should get back, so, but you just want to call out thanks to those individuals.
Anyone else? All right, well, thank you, John Paul, and we're going to take a 10-minute break before we come back and go on to the closed session. So, give everybody a chance to stretch and hit the blue. Okay, we will reconvene, and I'll entertain a motion for executive closed session.
Move that the board go into closed session as provided in KRS 61.840 bracket 1 for the purpose of discussion of proposed or pending litigation against or on behalf of the university.
A motion.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed,
aye.
Like sign. Okay. But we should. Even motion to.
So move to come out of the closed session.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. The board has now returned to open session. The discussions and deliberations during the closed session were restricted to those stated in the motion, and no formal action was taken by the board in closed session. We have some other announcements and dates for people to pay attention to. We're overdue to have our bylaws committee update our bylaws, and I have appointed the executive committee to do that work, and Regent Henson has kindly accepted to be chairman of our bylaws committee. We also need a nominating committee for officers at the end of the year, and John Ridley, Tamala, and George Nichols have kindly agreed to be on that committee. The other dates we have listed in at our last meeting, I mentioned that probably sometime in early to mid-July, we need to huddle either with a meeting here if we can get enough people, or if the process is in place as passed by the legislature, that we can do some of that video to have the board take a hard look at the strategic plan in its form at that time. A lot of work's gone on in that, and since our last meeting, the steering committee met with chairs of all the different committees. There was a lot of discussion, and there was a draft present at that time. I think it's going to be amended and weaned some more, but ultimately it is this board that will accept the strategic plan. And even though each one of you have been involved on at least one of the committees and have had input, it will be time to look at the strategic plan in total and anticipate then prior to the August convocation that we would pass that.
Dr. Bailey didn't appoint a chairman for the nominating committee. You said he was on the committee, but you didn't.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Mr. Reed is accepted. Yeah.
And on the upcoming calendar date, the committee meeting is October 26th. That's also the day of August. Unless we're doing it differently. So will we be able to attend? How the Hall of Distinguished Alumni Lunch? Is that same Friday? So it's a Friday before homecoming.
Right.
And we have a Board of Regents committee meeting.
We've always done that, but we can certainly entertain. We've done it to avoid you all coming back multiple times. But we can certainly
do it. Everybody needs to get in here, get their business done, and leave.
Right.
Okay. So you need to stay on that timer.
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
Presentation.
What is on the 26th?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, Doctor. I just wanted to bring that up because I wanted to just kind of qualify that. So that means get in here, get your business done.
That's right.
All right. Anyone else have any comments or concerns about any of these things?
Sorry, Richard Bale. One of the things I do want us to pay attention to, and I just thought of this, so my apologies for bringing it late. We've had some overlap between Regents meetings and the CPE meetings that have disallowed me from being present. And so I would like for us to make sure that as we do that, we take a close look at that calendar, that we don't create gaps in my attendance at those.
Yeah.
It was pretty important.
What happens is they set theirs after we do, but we can certainly adjust. Yeah.
Any instructions for this afternoon parking?
And you all will park in the Gate of Regents lot, same where you park for this meeting, and we will shuttle to our office so that when you are finished this evening, you're close to your vehicle.
Be there.
So at that we're supposed to be at the bus?
They will be there any time starting between group 30 and 4, but probably the last time will be about 5 minutes to 4.
And they're going to bring our jackets and things down to Smith Stadium.
Correct.
And it's 80 degrees with those ropes.
Yes.
Did you get summer ropes?
No, summer ropes. No short.
One of our major, before we end this meeting, one of our major responsibilities, as everyone here knows, is to hire a president of this university and support that individual in any way that we possibly can. I think that at these meetings, there are opportunities to publicly, if there's anything on the president's mind, that he needs to ask the board for his assistance and help in a public forum. I think that we should include that each and every time, because he can speak to each one of us individually, but as a collective group, if he has something that he needs to say to us as a board, I think that would be appropriate. So I would like to begin remarks from the president, questions to the board, whatever it might be, as an agenda item so that it gives the opportunity formally for the president. And I'm sorry to catch you off guard on this because we have not talked about this. But I would like to entertain that and an opportunity even now for the president to ask the board if there's anything on his mind that he needs our direct support publicly.
Regent Ridley, I appreciate the opportunity. And while it is a surprise to have it, obviously, I've been reflecting on the past 9 or 10 months, given what this week is in commencement and the culmination of at least the academic portion of my first year. And while I don't have anything to ask in particular, I will share this, that this was not the inaugural year that I would have
planned if you asked me a year ago, but I'm thankful that we've made significant progress, increased transparency, and collaborated in a way that we've not done before, as strong as we've done before. And so I think that is a positive. The other, and this is the thing that gives me most solace, is that as we end these conversations and talk about the budget going forward, we begin a new set of conversations, and that's about how the strategic plan, a new budget model, a new campaign, and all the work we're doing will enable us to climb to greater heights. And so I appreciate the support this year, but more importantly, I look forward to the year to come.
Very good. Anyone else? If not, I think that concludes this portion of our meeting, and I'll entertain Bridget Johnson, second by Bridget Woodley. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.